eKatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge, simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of eKatra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're tackling something pretty fundamental, an idea that, well, it underpins a lot of modern economic thinking here in America.
Right. The idea that constant, you know, fast economic progress is just the norm, something we can bank on basically forever.
Exactly. But we're going deep into a book that really challenges that whole notion. It's Robert J. Gordon's big, influential work, The Rise and Fall of American Growth.
And Gordon doesn't just challenge it. He kind of turns it completely on its head. He argues pretty much the opposite.
He does. His core idea is that the amazing century of American growth, let's say roughly 1870 to 1970, wasn't the start of a trend. It was unique, a one-off, unrepeatable historical moment.
An anomaly. He actually calls it the special century.
The special century, yeah. And this isn't just academic history. It matters hugely for you listening right now.
Absolutely. Because if Gordon's right, then a lot of the economic anxiety we feel today, you know, wage is not really going anywhere for many people, this feeling that things have slowed down. Well, that might not be just a temporary blip. It could be the direct result of getting less and less bang for our buck from new technology since around 1970. We could actually be living in the fall part of his title.
Okay. Heavy stuff.
Yeah.
So before we dive into that maybe slightly pessimistic view, let's talk about the author. Who is Robert J. Gordon? What gives him the authority to make such a huge claim about 150 years of history?
Well, he's the Stanley G. Harris Professor of Economics at Northwestern. He's been a leading voice on long-run economic growth and productivity for, well, for decades.
Okay. Established figure.
Definitely. But what makes his work really stand out isn't just his position, it's his approach. He combines really rigorous data analysis, crunching the numbers, with a very sharp historical perspective. He's looking at data going back, like you said, 150 years.
So not just reacting to the latest quarterly report, he's looking at the really long view, and there's a specific metric he focuses on, right? TFP.
That's it. Total factor productivity, or TFP. You can think of it as the secret sauce in economic growth. It measures efficiency, how much output, how much stuff we get from the labor and capital we put in.
So it's like a measure of how good we are at using our resources, how much innovation is actually doing something.
Exactly. It's probably the purest way to see the real economic impact of technological change. If an innovation is truly transformative, TFP should, you know, shoot up.
That's a really useful distinction. He's saying don't just look at the headline GDP number, which can go up for other reasons, like more debt or just more people. Look at the underlying efficiency engine of the economy.
Right. And what Gordon finds when he tracks TFP over that long stretch, well, leads him to a very powerful and, frankly, pretty contrarian view. It really forces us to question the sort of relentless techno-optimism we hear a lot about today.
He's saying that optimism needs to be based on the evidence, not just assumed.
You got it. His data drives his conclusions.
Okay, so that brings us squarely to the book's main argument. Let's break it down. The rise first. What were these great inventions that powered that special century?
So the huge growth spurt from 1870 to 1970, Gordon argues, was driven by the Second Industrial Revolution. We're talking about really foundational general purpose technologies, things like electricity becoming widespread, the internal combustion engine, you know, cars, trucks, planes.
Right, big ones.
Huge. And also modern plumbing and sanitation in cities and major advances in medicine.
These weren't just like slightly better versions of old things. These are complete game changers.
Yeah.
They tackled fundamental problems of, well, just staying alive and daily living. They took people from a life that hadn't changed that much for centuries and boom, suddenly propelled them into the modern industrial world.
A total transformation. But then, Gordon points out, since about 1970, even with the arrival of the Third Industrial Revolution, the digital age, computers, the internet, overall productivity growth, that TFP number, it's slowed way down.
Right. He argues the digital revolution, for all its wonders, has actually had a much smaller and kind of narrower impact on overall productivity compared to those earlier breakthroughs.
Yeah, less bang for the buck, essentially.
And his prediction, his diagnosis, is pretty blunt then.
It is. He basically says the U.S. economy is probably not going back to those super fast growth rates of the past. Why? Because the low-hanging fruit of technology, the really big foundational problems that those earlier inventions solved well, they've mostly been picked.
So it's a two-part argument, really. First, the pace of truly fundamental innovation is slowed.
Yes.
And second, there are these other big problems, these headwinds, that are holding back even the benefits of the innovation we do get.
Precisely. Less fuel in the engine and more brakes being applied at the same time.
Okay, let's dig into that rise part a bit more.
Yeah.
To really feel the impact, we need to understand what life was like before these great inventions took hold. What was the baseline in, say, 1870?
Oh, it was grim by our standards.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about a world that was literally dark after sunset for most people. Manual labor was incredibly hard, back-breaking stuff, especially in the home.
Household chores were unbelievably difficult.
Unbelievably. And huge parts of the country were really isolated. Travel was slow, difficult, and maybe most importantly, life expectancy was much shorter. Contaminated water, poor sanitation. They meant diseases like cholera, typhoid. They were rampant, especially in cities.
And Gordon has that famous thought experiment to really hammer this home, right? The plumbing versus the smartphone thing.
Yeah, it's brilliant. He asks you to imagine you have a choice. Option one, you get to keep all the technology invented up to, say, 2004. So you get the internet, your smartphone, all that digital stuff. But you have to give up modern indoor plumbing. No flushing toilets, no clean running water on tap.
Oof, okay.
Option two, you keep everything invented up to maybe 1950. So you definitely get the indoor plumbing, the clean water, electricity, cars, antibiotics. But you have to give up everything invented since then. No internet, no smartphones, no modern computers.
Wow. And most people, when they really think about it, they choose.
They choose the plumbing. Almost always. It just instantly shows how incredibly fundamental those earlier, maybe less glamorous innovations were. Clean water and sanitation didn't just make life more convenient, they dramatically boosted health, well-being, life expectancy for everyone.
Well, it wasn't just one invention either, was it? He talks about the synergy.
Exactly. These things worked together, reinforcing each other. Think about the networked home, as he calls it. Electricity wasn't just about light bulbs. It completely changed factories, allowed for assembly lines, huge efficiency gains.
And freed up labor in the home too, right? Appliances.
Washing machines, refrigerators. These things saved hours of grueling domestic work every single day, mostly done by women. That's a huge productivity gain right there.
And the internal combustion engine did the same kind of thing outside the home.
You could say that. Cars didn't just mean faster travel. They basically created suburbs, ended the deep isolation of rural areas, and completely revolutionized supply chains with trucks and later air travel.
But you mentioned sanitation earlier. Maybe that was the biggest one of all.
Arguably, yes. Building networks for clean water coming in and sewage going out in cities, that might have been the single most important change for human flourishing in that whole period. Just conquering those waterborne infectious diseases had an immediate massive impact on health and therefore productivity.
Okay, so that paints a picture of truly transformative change. Now let's jump forward. Post-1970, the digital age. Gordon says its impact is narrower, but hang on, look around today, AI, generative tech. Isn't that changing everything? Doesn't that kind of blow a hole in his argument?
That's the obvious challenge, and Gordon tackles it head on. He says, okay, let's look at the productivity data, the TFP numbers again. Right. And what they show is that the big productivity surge from computers actually happened mostly in the late 1990s, early 2000s.
What was driving it then?
It was mainly driven by things like businesses finally figuring out how to use computers to make their logistics and supply chains way more efficient. Think about how Walmart or early Amazon used tech to manage inventory and distribution. That was a huge, but maybe one-time, game in efficiency.
Ah, so those were improvements in how businesses operated, how they moved stuff around, managed information.
Exactly. More about optimizing existing processes using IT. Since around 2004, Gordon argues, yes, we've had this explosion of smartphones, social media, streaming, incredible digital tools, but their main impact, it's been on communication, on information access, and crucially, on leisure and entertainment.
So we spend all day using this stuff, but it's not necessarily making the core parts of the economy like construction or healthcare or education or restaurants fundamentally more productive in the same way electricity did.
That's his argument. These new innovations are amazing for how we spend our free time, how we connect with each other, how we get information. But they haven't translated into broad-based TFP growth across the whole economy in the same way the earlier inventions did.
That distinction between leisure improvements and broad productivity improvements, and that's quite sobering, actually.
It is. But Gordon's argument doesn't stop there. Even if we did have amazing new innovations popping up, he says there's another set of problems holding us back.
Right. This is the second half of his argument, the headwinds
Exactly. The six structural headwinds. These are big economy-wide problems that act like brakes on growth, regardless of the pace of technological change.
Okay, this sounds serious. A formidable list, you called it. What are these six headwinds dragging us down?
Okay, he lists them as 1, rising inequality, 2, problems in education, 3, demographics, like the aging population, 4, environmental constraints and the costs of dealing with them, 5, huge levels of debt, both government and consumer, and 6, the fact that the big benefits of globalization might be mostly behind us.
Wow. Okay, let's quickly touch on each. Inequality, he means the gap between the rich and everyone else is getting wider.
Yeah, specifically the concentration of income and wealth at the very top, the top 1%. He argues this limits opportunities and human capital development for the vast majority, which ultimately holds back the whole economy. If potential isn't nurtured broadly, growth suffers.
And education, is it just about cost?
Cost is a big part, rising student debt, but also that educational attainment levels, like college completion rates, have kind of plateaued since the 1970s after rising rapidly before that. So we're maybe not improving the skills of the workforce as quickly.
Okay. Demographics, that's the aging population, right?
Yeah.
Baby boomers retiring.
That's a huge factor. More retirees relative to active workers puts a strain on Social Security, healthcare, and means a potentially slower growing labor force. It increases the dependency ratio.
Environmental constraints, dealing with climate change, basically.
Yeah, the need to invest in adapting to climate change, shifting to renewables, dealing with resource scarcity. These things cost money and divert capital that might otherwise go into, say, boosting immediate productivity. It's necessary, but it's a cost.
Then debt. That seems straightforward. Government debt, consumer debt. It limits our flexibility.
Exactly. High debt levels can mean higher taxes, reduced government spending on things like infrastructure or R&D, or just makes the economy more vulnerable to shocks. It constrains future choices.
And finally, globalization's benefits are exhausted. What does that mean?
Just that the huge boost we got from bringing, say, China and other large economies into the global manufacturing system, getting access to cheaper goods and labor, those big, easy gains have largely already happened. The low-hanging fruit of globalization has been picked, similar to the technology argument.
So it's a pretty challenging picture. We've got maybe less powerful technological leaps forward and these powerful structural forces pushing back against growth.
That's the core of it. And it leads to his really critical conclusion. We absolutely need to adjust our expectations about future growth. We have to stop thinking that the incredibly rapid growth we saw in the mid-20th century, that post-war golden age, is somehow normal or something we're entitled to.
He keeps hammering that point. That special century was the anomaly. Driven by unique foundational changes that just can't be repeated. You only invent electricity once. You only conquer infectious diseases once.
Right. And that connects to another key idea he calls the hierarchy of technological needs. Think of it like Maslow's hierarchy, but for technology's economic impact.
Okay, how does that work?
Basically, innovations that solve fundamental problems of survival, health, basic movement and communication, like clean water, antibiotics, the engine, the telegraph, they have a massive economic payoff. But as technology moves up the hierarchy to things that mostly enhance convenience or entertainment,
Like maybe social media apps or faster streaming.
the marginal economic benefit, the impact on overall productivity and living standards for everyone gets smaller. It's still innovation, but its effect diminishes.
That's a powerful lens for thinking about where we should focus our efforts, isn't it? It suggests maybe fixing the fundamental institutional problems, those headwinds.
Exactly. It might be more important than just waiting for the next cool gadget. And this really highlights another theme. The crucial difference between just looking at GDP figures and looking at the actual standard of living for the average person.
Right. GDP can go up,
Yeah.
but if all the gains go to the top 1% and the headwinds like debt and poor education are holding back the median person, their actual daily life, their well-being might not be improving much at all.
Gordon's really focused on the bottom 99% and how their lives changed or haven't changed as much recently.
The book has some really memorable lines that capture this skepticism. You mentioned one earlier.
Yeah, like the economic revolution of 1870 to 1970 was unique in human history, unrepeatable because so many of its achievements could happen only once. That just perfectly sums up the core idea of the special
It
century.
really does capture that foundational one-time transformation,
Yeah.
moving from darkness to light, like you
Yeah.
said.
And then there's this one, which directly pushes back against simple techno-optimism. Innovation creates new products and processes, but not all innovation has an equal impact on productivity and economic growth.
That's the heart of his argument about the digital age having a narrower impact, isn't it?
Absolutely. Not all progress is created equal, economically speaking.
So, okay, let's bring this home. What are the real-life takeaways here? If we kind of accept this possibility of slower growth, what does that mean for you listening?
Well, on a personal level, for individual financial planning, it might mean adjusting expectations. Lower expected returns on investments over the long haul, maybe slower wage growth than previous generations experienced. The old assumption that each generation will automatically be much better off might need rethinking.
And in terms of careers, it suggests focusing on skills that work with new technology, that complement AI and automation, rather than skills that directly compete with it and might be automated away.
That makes sense. And for business leaders, the message is probably to be realistic about long-term growth projections. Don't just assume the high growth rates of the past will continue indefinitely. Maybe be a bit skeptical of forecasts based on that.
And perhaps focus more on making existing operations more efficient, getting productivity gains from the systems you already have, rather than betting everything on some revolutionary disruption that might or might not deliver broad gains.
That seems like a prudent takeaway. But maybe the biggest implications are for policymakers, for voters. The core message seems to be technology alone won't solve our biggest problems.
Right. If Gordon's right, then the policy focus really needs to shift towards tackling those headwinds head on. Mm-hmm. Things like reducing inequality, improving education access and quality, investing in infrastructure, managing debt.
Because those are the things constraining progress for the average person now. Technology is great, but its benefits are being blocked or diluted by these deeper structural issues.
Gordon has another quote about that, doesn't he? About the headwinds being fundamental.
Yes. The headwinds that slow economic growth are not temporary reversals, but fundamental changes in the economic environment. In other words, these aren't just cyclical bumps in the road. They're deep-seated problems we have to actively fix.
So if we don't address inequality or debt or education, then even if we get the next amazing AI breakthrough, its benefits might just get canceled out by those headwinds or only flow to a tiny group at the top.
That seems to be the warning.
You know, what really struck me diving into this wasn't just the pessimism, though it is sobering. It was the sheer scale and speed of the change during that special century. We kind of take our modern world for granted, but realizing how much life transformed from, you know, horse-drawn carts and outhouses to jets and antibiotics in just 50 or 70 years, it's staggering.
It really is. We're sort of living on this high plateau that was built incredibly quickly by our grandparents and great-grandparents, and maybe we mistook reaching the plateau for the start of an even steeper climb that just wasn't sustainable.
Yeah, a powerful reframing.
For me, the final thought, maybe the most provocative one for listeners, is this. Gordon's analysis suggests our future prosperity, our kids' future prosperity. It might depend less on inventing the next amazing gadget or AI model, and more on whether we have the political will and social cohesion to actually tackle these big, messy structural problems, the inequality, the debt, the education system, the environmental challenges. That's where the real bottleneck to better lives might actually be.
A challenging thought to end on. Fixing ourselves might be more important than inventing the next big thing.
Seems that way.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.